News Talk 590 WVLK. Good morning. Friday morning. Scott Johnson in for Jack Patty one more time this morning, and it is Forensic Friday. American DA live, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson and a cast of thousands. Good morning.
Good morning, Scott.
And as I understand, happy birthday.
It is. It's and I got to the office today, and the people in our office with whom I work had just trashed my office.
Good and, for them.
And, of course, they all want to know how did I react, and, of course, I'm just always effervescent. that's just the way it is. Andrea was all part of it, and so was Allison Beck. Mary Houlihan, of course, took the day off.
That's right.
Because we just finished with that Martha Post murder trial. And, you know, it's interesting. Most of the time you refer to trials by the bad guy, the defendant. And in this one, we referred to it as the Martha Post case. Today we want to talk about, if I can, to introduce what we're here about.
Please do.
It was a a prescription pill triple homicide, frankly. And this was the serious outcome that all too often happens when you're dealing with these prescription pill dealers. And William Blancett was one of those. And Andrea was the prosecutor in the case, and Andrea Williams. And so she's here with us today. And also with us is we have dragged James Curless, also known as Lieutenant James Curless, who for a long time was head of the robbery homicide unit at the Lexington Division of Police. And we got James out and dusted him off and brought him back, and because he was in charge of the unit when this happened. And of course, Mary Houlihan is our victim's advocate. And when we do the cast of thousands, as you and Jack say, it's, you know, it takes a lot of people to do these cases, to investigate them and everything else. And it's not just a one-man band. And so we want the people that were responsible for these things to talk about it, because they work awfully hard on it. So, Andrea, welcome to the again.
And welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Now, we haven't, Curless, we haven't seen you for a while. You've been here before, but you've retirement has kept you out of the hot seat for a while, I guess.
That's correct. It's been good.
Has it been?
It has. It has.
I guess just lie to us and tell us you miss us.
I miss you a lot, Ray.
There you go.
Smile off his face.
Yeah.
Well, Andrea, tell us, introduce this case.
Back on January 4th of 2011, the police were notified of, I guess, some victims being in a house after they got the 911 calls. Police responded, and when they responded to the house, it was over off of Polo Club Boulevard back in the Hamburg area. Police discovered three victims within the house. At that point, police started to investigate. Two of the victims were taken to the University of Kentucky Hospital, but were did not survive their injuries and were basically pronounced dead once they were at the hospital. One of the victims was not transported because he was pronounced dead at the scene. At that point, police started to investigate.
Let me stop here for a minute. James, would you tell us, you get the call as the commander of the robbery homicide unit, and one of the calls you made was to me.
That's correct. I called you up and met you out at the scene.
All right. Well, tell us what is the robbery homicide unit do when you get something in which there are three people who have been murdered? How do you organize the investigation of that case?
Well, I don't know that it matters if it's one or three homicides. It's pretty much the same procedure. We're going to seal off the scene. We're going to call in our evidence collection people, our FSU people. Obviously, we call you to the scene. We bring in several investigators, and we start our investigation, talking to people that were there that knew something about these people. They trafficked in narcotics and drugs. So when that happens, it's a little bit more difficult because they're running under the radar, so to speak. So we have to ferret out that information sometimes a little bit harder, but we were successful in this case.
Okay. So, Andrea, the case comes to our office as a triple murder.
Correct.
Now, what does that mean as it relates to charges and penalties and all that sort of thing?
In this case, Mr. Blansett was charged with three counts of murder, but in addition to the murder, he was charged with robbery and two counts of wanton endangerment in the first degree, because when the killings took place, the police determined that there were two small children laying on the couch asleep in the house where the murders took place and were within feet of these small children. Luckily, the children were not hurt in any way. But due to the fact that there were two aggravators in the case, one being more than one person was killed, and there was a robbery involved, it was a death-eligible case for Mr. Blansett.
Well, let me stop here and do a little education. Not every murder that occurs is eligible for the death penalty.
Right.
It has to be one that's accompanied by what Andrea called an aggravating circumstance. And those kind of things are multiple murder. And this was three. Remember Timothy McVeigh killed 167. That's a multiple murder. LaFonda Faye Foster killed five people. That's multiple murder. So that's an aggravating circumstance. Another one is, if a murder occurs in the course of a robbery in the first degree or a kidnapping or a rape, that's an aggravating circumstance. If you use a bomb or a destructive device, that's an aggravating circumstance. If you kill a police officer in the course of his duties, that's an aggravating circumstance. If somebody just walked in here, Scott, and didn't like what you were saying on the radio this morning, just walked in here and just shot you and killed you, your mother would think it deserves the death penalty, but
yeah,
the law doesn't.
Sure.
You see, so this had a couple of aggravating circumstances. It was a multiple murder, three, and it occurred in the course of a robbery in the first degree.
All right, we'll take it from there after the break. Ray Larson, Andrea Williams, James Curless, Mary Houlihan, all with us this morning. If you've got questions or comments about this case, let us know at 253-5959. News Talk 590 WVLK. Forensic Friday, American DA Live, Commonwealth's attorney Ray Larson is here, along with Andrea Williams, James Curless, Mary Houlihan. We're talking about the case against William Blansett Sr. from 2011, January 2011. It was a heck of a way to start a new year.
Right.
That was an awful afternoon for the whole town, really, because everybody was watching that case as it went down that day.
Well, you know, there are a lot of family members that are hit by this tragedy, and it is. Anytime somebody loses a life, I'm really, regardless of the situation that they're in, but everybody's a loser in that deal. Okay, Andrea, why don't you talk a little bit about how you, this is clearly a death penalty eligible case, and does that make it any more difficult to deal with, and how do you go about putting together this case? Because I know you had to work with James Curless's bunch and Bill Breslin, who was the lead detective. So tell us a little bit about how you go about getting ready for this kind of a case.
Well, after we get the case in our office, of course, you start to look through everything. At that point, we were still waiting for some DNA to come back. And we start meeting with the detectives to make sure that we have everything ready.
Meaning all of their investigative
files. All of the recordings, because oftentimes in murder cases, there are photographs, there are recordings of witnesses that the police take, and those can be quite numerous. And in this case, it was a number of people that they talked to try to figure out why this happened, how this happened. You have to speak with the medical examiners because they will eventually testify at trial about the cause of death. But the Lexington Homicide Unit does a fantastic job of getting all of that information and interviewing witnesses and recording that information for the prosecutors. So they bring their entire file over to our office so we can begin to prepare for trial. And as Lieutenant Curlis said earlier, although this is a death penalty case, the way to prepare is not truly any different than any other murder case. The only real difference is the voir dire that will take place. That takes longer than it would in a regular homicide case or a non-death penalty homicide case. And so you basically prepare in the same manner. The only real difference is to prepare for the voir dire and the sentencing phases.
The voir dire is...
Jury
selection.
Is the jury selection process. Now, what's the difference?
For a death penalty trial, the clerk's office will call in many more people to be potential jurors. Oftentimes, the jurors will fill out a questionnaire. The questionnaire involves some information about their feelings about the death penalty, because obviously many people have strong pro and con for the death penalty. And then in a death penalty case, unlike a non-death penalty murder case, you get to individually ask, and it's called individual voir dires, where the jurors come in one at a time and you get to ask them various questions, as opposed to a non-death penalty case where you just ask the entire jury panel a set of questions.
Mm-hmm. So the issue has to do with the questions they ask about are publicity, and they ask about racial issues. Those are the two. Now, that periodically there'll be others that are suggested to the judge, and the judge says, okay, you can talk about that during the individual portion of the jury selection process. And any rate, that's how that worked. Now, tell us a little bit, if you would, about how long did it take before this thing was filed?
It was scheduled on a couple of different occasions before the final date was set, but it was set to be tried in June of this year, 2013. So about 2.5 years after the murders was when it was actually set to go to trial.
One of the questions I get asked probably once a day is, why does it take so long to get cases? Because we just tried this Martha Post case, and that was 2 years.
But on the other hand, you see some that go within 6 months. Why are some longer than others? That's my question.
I don't think you're going to try a homicide case in Lexington,
Kentucky. Well, maybe it ain't your jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But, okay.
But where did you see
You know, this? I can't bring up specifics, but it feels like it sometimes that... And maybe that's after they've worked out a deal. Maybe that's a part of it too. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But sometimes it feels like you see stories in the media where, gosh, this one happened in May and they're sentencing the guy today.
Yeah. Well, that may be, but it's around here, it's gotten to the point that you can't try a case before a homicide case before 2 years.
I interrupted you. Why? Why does it take so long?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. There was a time when I first became Commonwealth Attorney here that we would try 93% or dispose of 93% of the cases within 31 days of the time they were indicted.
Wow.
Now, then comes DNA, and then DNA clicks in about 6 months, you see, because okay. that's the way it is.
Time.
And
yeah.
then, and what are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, DNA is part of it, or waiting for all lab results, because the lab that in Frankfort covers the eastern half of Kentucky. So they are very busy and have tons of cases that come in. So waiting for lab results, attorney schedules, oftentimes the defense needs more time to investigate for the sentencing phase, or just to talk with the witnesses themselves and that sort of thing. So a lot of it is scheduling, waiting for particular results, that sort of thing.
Talking about the case against William Blancett Sr., Andrea Williams, Ray Larson, James Curlis, Mary Houlihan, all here. And we'll be back with all of them right after the break here on News Talk 590 WVLK.
The news you expect, the balance you've asked for. News Talk 590 WVLK. Depend on it.
News Talk 590 WVLK, Forensic Friday. American DA Live, I'm Scott Johnson, and with us this hour, from left to right as you look at the radio, Mary Houlihan, James Curlis, Andrea Williams, birthday boy Ray Larson. And we are discussing the case against William Blancett. It's a murder case. The murders themselves happened on January 4th of 2011. Got to wait a minute while Larson checks his text messages flowing in. So every time we mention the birthday, it goes ding, 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 ding.
We got a tweeter from a guy, the prosecutor in Bowling Green, Chris Coron. Chris Coron.
Who's been on this show before.
Yeah, and he's a smart mouth. And he said, well, happy birthday. Isn't it amazing what senior citizens are doing these days? What? I get no respect, Scott.
Poor Ray.
Yeah, yeah.
Poor Ray.
Mary, tell us what happens with families in this kind of a situation. You deal with families in some of the worst situations ever.
Yes, in fact, and the brother-in-law of one of the victims called in and just wanted to say that, you know, what wonderful people that these victims were. And certainly while there's choices involved in everyone's life that should something like this happen are suddenly exposed, we absolutely agree. These are three people that did not deserve to die, and that there's, you know, throughout working on a case like this, you hear all sorts of nice things about the victims themselves. This triple homicide was my first time working a murder case with multiple victims, and it does present unique problems because everybody brings a different kind of grief to the table in any situation. But when you have three different victims and family of three different people, even though two of those victims were related, their connections to family are different. Mm-hmm. It can be quite complicated. And initially there was, just like after any murder case, there's a lot of talk going on in the community, and there's a lot of people assuming things about the criminal justice system that just don't actually happen. And we kind of had to get to a place where they trusted that we're trying to do our best for the case, and we're going to give you any information we can and that we have. And really, by the time the case concluded and we ended our time with the family, I think they did trust that we were trying to do everything that we could to help them. But there's, you know, only so much the criminal justice system can do in the face of murder of any sort, because the reality is these families are left with the loss that they had before the criminal justice system ever got involved and after it's long gone.
Sure.
And these victims were sons, they were fathers, they were, you know, loved dearly and deeply by their families, and that grief just compounds everything. And two of the victims were related, and that family just experienced a tremendous amount of grief because they not only lost a father, but they lost a son, and the small children in the house lost a father and a grandfather. So it was just a really horrible situation for the victims and their families.
One of the things that Mary and the people that work with Mary, our victims' advocates, do very quickly when a homicide occurs, gathers up, and we call it a family meeting, is what we call it, because they've got a lot of questions and they want answers, and they want them pretty quickly. And so what happens is we typically will ask them to come to the office, We'll ask the detectives who were involved in the case to join us, and the prosecutor who will be handling the case. And we say, here's the deal. Well, we're happy to answer any question you have, but you have to agree to keep your mouth shut until this case is completed. Now, we can't have you out there blabbing on the street about facts and circumstances surrounding the case, but we will tell you all of the facts and circumstances you want to know. A lot of them don't want to know anything, but most of them want to know every detail. And so I think once we have that meeting, they begin to understand the process that we're going to go through, but they continue to have questions, and that's where our victims' advocates are so valuable to us.
You say a lot of them don't want to know anything. Why?
They just don't want. They just don't. There are two kinds of victims in homicide cases: those that want to know every detail, and there are those that just block it.
Intrusive on their grieving.
It's too painful, and sudden violent death is a very hard thing to get your mind around. You may have been somebody that didn't like the sight of blood, the sight of these sorts of situations anyway. You're not a rubbernecker. You don't look at the traffic accident, and then this happens in such close proximity to your life. There's just those people that know that they'd rather hold the image of their loved one that they had previously in their hearts, which is actually what I would suggest in every case, but I understand that need to know what their last moments were like.
Andrea, this case did not go to trial, and this is a death penalty case. And in our office, we have a policy that if a case is a homicide case, then typically those will go to trial unless the evidence just heads south on us. But in death penalty cases, we just charge them as such, and we seek the death penalty, and then, of course, let the jury make that decision. Those are the people that decide whether a death penalty is going to happen or not. So what happened in this case?
We were about a week from trial, and we got information from the defense attorneys that he was willing to plead to the maximum on all of the underlying charges and take life without the possibility of parole, that he would spend the rest of his life in prison for the three murders. At that point, we started to talk with the family. We talked with the Lexington Division of Police, the homicide detectives in the case, and we determined that it would be best in this case to allow him to plead to life without the possibility of parole. This family had been through the ringer for 2 years. They knew that, like in any murder case, part of the defense strategy would be to attack their loved ones and try to place some of the blame on their loved ones, which is awful for any victim to have to sit through, or victim's family to have to sit through. So we made the decision to allow him to plead and made the recommendation that he spend the rest of his life in prison. He will never get out. There will be no appeal in the case. So the family has some sort of finality, and they can hopefully start to heal in the case.
We're going to wrap up this case in just a moment. Andrea Williams is with us, along with Ray Larson, Mary Houlihan, James Curless. It is American DA Live here on News Talk 590 WVLK, 947 right now. News Talk 590 WVLK, Forensic Friday, American DA Live. Last couple of minutes here with Ray Larson, Andrea Williams, James Curless, Mary Houlihan. I'm Scott Johnson. Before the break, Ray, you talked about how on a capital case you want to go to trial with that, but in this case you didn't. You accepted the plea that sent Mr. Blancett to jail for the rest of his life, no appeals. Is there an inconsistency there? You're going to go to trial, but this guy didn't.
One of the things that we try to do is let juries make decisions in homicide cases. And in death penalty cases, the defense scrutinizes every decision that we make, because they'll make a motion to set take the death penalty off the table and that sort of thing. And we try to be very consistent in that we seek it when it qualifies. But the other thing is when somebody wants to plead guilty and go to prison on a life without parole sentence, then we have to consider that simply because given the decades of appeals and the uncertainty of appeals and that sort of thing, it's that kind of a plea is a good one. And so that's we do that frequently if they offer.
Okay. JD, good morning. You're on News Talk 590 WVLK.
Good morning. Appreciate the show. But just an observation. I hear these sob sisters that are trying to do away with the death penalty altogether, and then they always say that what the criminals fear most is life without parole. But somehow, almost in every case, they immediately, when they know you got the goods on them, they make a plea bargain for life without parole instead of the death penalty. Just an observation.
Right. That's a great observation. I'm going to tell you something. If these people who say I'd rather be sentenced to death than to spend the rest of my life in prison could read all of the desperate appeals by these people on death row, they'd just laugh at them. I want to talk very quickly about back to James, and that is how this first 48 is very important in solving these crimes, and tell us very quickly, James, how this happened exactly in this case.
In this particular case, we were doing our investigation. We were going to different residences, following up on some of the information that we had gathered from the family and friends. And just so happened, went to this one house and observed Mr. Blancett was going to come down to the police department with us, and he tried to hide what turns out to be the barrel of the gun in a vehicle, which we recovered, and it broke open the case, so to speak.
Well, one thing about it, our robbery homicide unit solves over 90% of the homicides that occur in Lexington, which is well above the national average. In Detroit, for example, they solve 10%. And in Chicago, they only solve 52%. So first of all, we live in a safe community, but we got a good robbery homicide unit that's really on the ball. Even since James has left, they're continuing to do the tradition.
They have managed to get along without him and continue to
No. That's hard, but Brian Maynard has done a good job.
All right. Thank you all for coming in this morning, and thanks to you, Ray. You'll be back next week.
Yep.
With another interesting case with Jack. And thanks, everybody. It's about time to get out of here, and as I say, they're going to have to drag me kicking and screaming out of here just like usual, but Jack is scheduled to be back on Monday morning, and we'll see if we have to duke it out to see who gets to keep the chair and keep the show. Thank you so much for your indulgence, and thank you for allowing me to join you every morning this week. Nobody has more fun doing this than I do. I insist on that, at least.